Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Stay with us. We have a very interesting program with a return guest. His name is Adam C. Hall. He is the author of The Earth Keepers, Undeveloping the Earth. I'm not sure if that has anything to do with tearing everything down and starting over, or maybe it's not tearing anything down. Stay with us. We'll find out what all of this means here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Don't you go anywhere.
Walk with me. Talk with me. Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And as I said before, welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are a broadcast on a2zen.fm. You'll need to check their listings at their website, a2zen.fm. And we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. So lots of information, lots of opportunities. And we also have links to our guests, just like Adam C. Hall, who is in studio with me today. And we're gonna mention up front a couple of times throughout the program that you have a special event coming up in Uptown Santa Barbara, California at the Chaucer's Bookstore featuring you and your work, The Earth Keeper, Undeveloping the Future. First of all, thank you for coming to the program.
Richard, it's great to see you again, and looking forward to having a little fun today with everybody.
Absolutely, and of course you have a book signing.
Yes, coming up on Thursday, March the 6th at 7 p.m. at the famous Chaucer's Bookstore. I encourage everybody to come on out, say hello, and support our local indie bookstore. You know, we got to watch out for those big behemoths like Amazon. So indie bookstores are important, and so please join me next Thursday, March 6th at 7 o'clock. Love to say hello to you.
That'd be great to have folks come out. And I would agree with you in that respect, because there is nothing like going into a bookstore. And I don't know, the aroma of the paper and the ink is intoxicating. It doesn't cause any hallucinogenic effects, but it is a wonderful reminder that you can pick up a physical book. And I mean, I have stacks of them at home, bookcases full of books. Some of them I've read and some of them I'm still waiting to read. But going into a library is the same kind of thing. I mean, it's an extraordinary feeling to know that I can pull anything off of the shelf. I can't access it maybe as fast as I could, maybe in a Kindle or Googling it. But the feel, be honest with you, just the tactile experience, there's nothing like it from my growing up.
I'm with you on that. I enjoy getting lost in the library or the bookstore. I mean, sometimes I just let my imagination run a little bit wild and head off into a section that I hadn't been in before. But the physical books are something to behold and touch, and I hope they never go away. I don't think they ever will.
You and me, I are in agreement there. It's just extraordinary, and I certainly hope that people will investigate these particular types of things as well. We're going to talk today, and we talked about this the last time you were on the program as well. We're going to talk today, of course, about the work that you are all about, and especially in light of this work that we're talking about today, and that is the Earth Keeper. And it's interesting, as you and I met, it seems like several years ago, but I don't know that it was that long ago. And we sat and we chatted. And one of the thoughts that came to mind was, as I mentioned at the outset of the program, let's bulldoze everything down and start over. For some, that probably wouldn't be a bad idea. Some people kind of feel that way, that we've just gone way too far. We have developed more than we should have ever developed. We're the only species on the planet, from my perspective, that takes raw materials, turns them into something else before it constructs its living quarters. Whereas you take a beaver, you take a bear, he's going to go into a cave or maybe in the stump of a tree or something like this, or take whatever natural raw materials are around, and he uses those raw materials to make his living space, or the birds making nests and so forth. They don't manufacture anything, not in the way that we do. And we end up doing more harm than good most of the time.
Well, of course, in the process, we create a tremendous impact on the Earth. The imprint is mind-boggling, and most folks really don't think about it. But when you think about buying just even a simple thing like a plastic baggie that's manufactured in a chemical plant in China and then shipped over across the sea, it's quite insane. But to get back to your original point, Richard, which is a good one, just because we perhaps have gone to one extreme of in terms of how we are living our lives and the lifestyles that we're living and the construction and the all the things we're doing doesn't mean we need to run to the other extreme either.
It's not wanting to throw the baby out with the bathwater, basically.
Yes, yes.
And we've
yes,
done harm. There's no question. Whether we're responsible for a lot of the climate issues that the planet is experiencing, there are those on one side who say, cyclical, this is just what happens. We can go back down through the centuries, the millennia, and this has happened many, many times in the past. Whether we've accelerated or not, I don't know. I'm not versed in those areas. Be that as it may, I even talk with the people who are of the ilk that we've had nothing to do with this. This is man is not, you know, responsible. My response to that is, but don't you still think that it would be prudent for us to kind of move forward with some of these better ways of living? Cleaner cars, if possible, getting rid of the process of, I mean, they now make the biodegradable bags. You know, I'm sure you're aware of those, but
I use them.
You know, I've got canvas. I've got all kinds of different bags in the car. I just have to remember to take them from the car into the grocery store when I go shopping.
Well, you're going to charge you 10 cents in Los Angeles if you don't do that. And soon.
It could be here.
Soon right here in Santa Barbara.
But we've gone through these kinds of technological changes over the last 200, 300, or 400 years as we have innovated, as we have created these new, we'll call them technologies. I always find it very interesting when talking about man in his early stages and the quote, and I've heard the term used, technologies that he had then. I'm going, a stick and a rock? The technology? I mean, we put that, and because I think technology, electronics, you know, futuristic stuff. That's my mindset as far as technology. But I guess it depends upon your definition.
Well, it's very relevant, Richard. I think you bring up a good point because on one hand, we were speaking a little bit a moment ago about climate change.
Yeah.
And you know, is it man-made? Is it a natural cycle of Earth? Well, it's neither of those. It's a combination of those.
Yeah.
So that's what's amazing about, you know, there's no reason to really be arguing about one or the other.
Right.
The conversation really should be, as we see it and that we're having in my universe, is really about what are we doing about it? What kind of actions are we taking? You know, when we hit 400 parts per billion in the upper atmosphere of the measuring centers in Hawaii of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that was the tipping point that most scientists said is the point of no return. Okay, well, if that's the case or not the case or whenever that point may be, whether it's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, we're already seeing the effects of that.
Yeah.
Obviously, we have extreme weather. We have a lot of different things going on. So obviously, it would be smart of us to heed those things and take action upon those things. And then there's others that speak of a technology.
Yeah.
You know, and what can technology do? It can do a lot, but there's a lot of things it can't do. Namely, what it can do, and let's obviously, you know, let's pay good attention and develop technology and do a lot of R&D around technological development, which we'll continue to do because in the U.S. in particular, we're the leaders in this field in terms of measurements or metrics or predictions of earthquakes or other types of events so that we can clear out of harm's way in a little bit of more of a timely manner. So technology does have a role, and it's these certainly are very exciting times.
Well, and they certainly are. And, of course, I'm also feeling that, for example, the winter of 2013-14, as we are speaking, has already seen some very unusual weather. Mm. Some say that has not been seen for decades, if not centuries. I don't know what the specific timetables are. And it makes me think, of course, the movie that came out, I want to say Day After Tomorrow, where this giant, I mean, enormous storm, circular storm, almost looked like a hurricane from above, came down from the north and just – blanketed the top third or half of the Northern Hemisphere with ice and snow. And so I hear these stories about this particular storm front. They're calling it a vortex. And I'm thinking, okay, why did you put that? Why are you using that word? And then when they talk about, for example, Sandy that hit the East Coast, and they keep referring to it as a superstorm, you know, they didn't. I don't know that they referred to Katrina as a superstorm. They just referred to it as Hurricane Katrina. I thought that was a hurricane. Sandy, that was a hurricane. It was a big one. We're seeing these kinds of events around the world, literally. And then I got to thinking about, you recall back in late 2013 in December, the ship, they got stuck in the Antarctic ice, eventually was, freed up.
And they're stuck again.
And apparently they're stuck again. And I'm sitting here going, okay, all right, we can push aside global warming because we got all this stuff going on. And that's what a lot of people will say. What global warming? We're freezing, you know. Well, we're talking about extremes in weather more than anything else. What can we do to fix those things is sort of a question we can put out there and maybe discuss. But even if there's nothing we can do to fix the problem, there are things that we can do that at least might help to, because there are those who believe that this is a living, breathing entity, the planet, to heal the planet, go in and try to administer some kind of, and I use the term loosely, antibiotics, suture things up and try to heal the planet in that regard.
Isn't that kind of silly, though?
It seems,
that,
it does.
That man, humankind can actually go in and effectuate a greater change around our planet in terms of healing it. It seems kind of silly. We're trying to do that with these, you know, all these kind of interesting little tweaks and twerks,
sure,
and this and that. But the point is a really good one, because what is relevant about what you're saying, Richard, is that it's about doing something. It's,
yeah,
not about doing nothing. And the question is, what is it that we do?
Well, you know, the gyres that are spinning around in the oceans. I think there are three of them around the globe.
I've heard about that. I don't know much about it, though.
Well, these are giant whirlpools, if you will, where the currents all seem to converge in that area of the world. And there are, I think, two or three of them around the world that are gathering up a lot of our garbage. And the one in the South Pacific, I believe the last I had heard was like something like the size of Texas. But what really got me was that the Earth is giving us an opportunity to do something, because it's gathering up all of this stuff. In other words, there's a natural recycling process that the Earth has in the oceans. And those gyres, filled with all of our plastic bags that we referred to earlier, among other things, it's gathering all that up. Now,
yeah,
how willing are we to begin that process, as monumental as it seems, if it is indeed the size of Texas, how willing are we to take that opportunity to clean that up? And there is a gentleman, I saw the video on TED. Are you familiar with the TED interview speeches? He has come up with a device that not only gathers all of this stuff up without harming the indigenous species and plants and animals and so forth that are in the ocean, but also converts all of this stuff into something that can be used, sold and used. So in other words, this isn't millions of dollars going into something that you'll never see a return on. This is actually a device that will have a return on it.
Yes, it's a great way to process plastics.
I thought, wow.
I think it.
What a mind.
It certainly is. And I think the technology and the ability to do that seems to be gathering steam. Whether it's economic or not, I don't know. But we should make it economical. But that doesn't address other big issues,
right,
like Fukushima. Mm-hmm. Radioactivity,
right,
in the air, in the oceans, where polluted our entire virtually our entire fisheries in the Pacific Ocean with hundreds of millions of gallons of radioactive water pouring in virtually daily around these type of events, or the tremendous amount of pollution that's coming out of China that actually floats over the western United States many, many days. So the point is a big one. What do we do about it? There's all kinds of things where we can innovate, where we can use technology, but I get back to the same thing. And that really is, where does it begin? And it begins with you and me. Yeah. And what do we do about it in our own personal lives in terms of not only what we're consuming, how we're consuming it, but what I found in when I actually was put together the book, The Earth Keeper, Undeveloping the Future, what I found was it begins with me. Yeah. I had to clean up my own self.
Yeah.
The self where I was polluting myself, and not to get off topic, but it's relevant because we do pollute our own lives.
Yeah.
We don't even think about it, but that's what we do to effectuate our lifestyles. And nothing wrong with a good lifestyle, so long as, might as well be conscious about how it's affecting our planet and others.
And I constantly go back to the other species on the planet. And I say, show me where another species is contaminating its living environment. And you won't find it.
You won't.
You won't, because they are connected. And that is one of the big issues that is brought up time and time again when it comes to us as humans trying to find that peace, that contentment, that centeredness. They always say, you need to go back and reconnect with nature. I mean, even if it's going to a park in the middle of a busy, urban setting, New York City, go to Central Park. You know, we have parks here in Santa Barbara. We have wilderness all around us and so forth. And they always talk about that. Go back to nature in whatever way you can do that. Even if it's just, having a little garden in your yard or outside your apartment or something of this nature. And that sort of begins a process. So you have to ask yourself, well, what is it about nature that is so so important that if we just reconnect with it, we begin this process that you're talking about in terms of cleaning up our own lives, both internally as well as externally in our own living spaces.
Very much so, Richard. They just had a study came out that they did a study in England of elementary school children. Hmm. And the study concluded that 4 out of 5 children of that formidable age are disconnected with nature.
Oh,
and they call it nature deficit disorder, NDD. And this is not just afflicting the children, but imagine that it's now being passed down generationally where we've lost our greater connectivity with the earth and with the blessings of the earth. And it's real easy to not think about that, but the power of nature and what I found, and I wrote about it extensively in the book, is it offers a great gift of wisdom and how to connect not only with the outer environment, but to find the greater connectivity within our own inner environment and the relationship that we have. And I don't know one person on this planet would say that with 7.5 billion people going to 10 billion, a billion people on this earth, I don't know one that would say that we are living in balance with nature.
Yeah.
And it's very evident that we're not, and that's why we're getting the effects that we are getting, and we haven't seen anything yet.
Well, and as a species covering the planet, I would tend to agree with you there, or whoever has put that together. I am interested also in some of the other work that you're doing on land in particular that you had been doing in terms of dealing with the places in which we live and work and even in some cases play that are indoors, that kind of thing, as it relates to, just because of the subtitle, Undeveloping the Future. And again, we're not talking about bulldozing cities like Los Angeles and New York and starting over again. That's not going to happen. But again, what we can do is begin the process of cleaning up our own little areas. I know that where I live up on the hill above Santa Barbara, I would never even consider, say, releasing any of the fluids from my automobile, because my mindset is, okay, I live up here, but what if I lived down below? Would I do that to me? No, because that's going to go downhill, and it's going to affect everything that it comes in contact with. So it's one of those things where I want to talk about the whole process of undeveloped. What is your definition of undeveloping in this context?
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because it is what I now feel is a key aspect of what we can develop individually and collectively going forward, and ultimately to create a more sustainable and prosperous earth and a more sustainable and prosperous life for ourselves. Undevelopment is a term that I coined out of my own personal journey, Richard. And undevelopment really is taking a look at all that that had occurred over my lifetime and all the various different disparate things that happened, whether it's as innocuous as being on fire, well, that's not so innocuous, when I was 12 years old, or marrying my next-door neighbor when I was 7, to other types of things when I went to school at Berkeley, to becoming a professional and getting into the real estate game and the development game as well. And it really is a process of taking a look at that collectively. If we put it all in a bowl and we looked at that, mm-hmm. I think we all could probably say, well, it served me in so many ways, and in other ways, these things are still affecting my life. And they're still influencing me on what I do and how I do things and how I consume things or how I treat my significant other or children. It applies in all aspects of our life. The idea of undevelopment grew out of my own personal journey of cleaning up my own environment, cleaning up my own earth, meaning my own self, to free it from anything that no longer served my journey. And the idea was, I've got to take it apart. I've got to deconstruct it to ultimately reconstruct it and repurpose myself and my life to be of greater service, to have more vitality, more happiness, more things that I really here to do, to share with others. And so I decided that, well, wait a second. If I can apply that and live that in my own life and share that with others and the power of that, then how does that manifest in my everyday life? Mm. How can I bring that knowledge and wisdom that I received along the path, so to speak, in nature from other teachers around the globe, other traditions, east and west, through my readings and my writings and reflections and contemplations, how can I bring the undevelopment paradigm into a real world experience? So what we're doing at the Earthkeeper Alliance, you can check it out at earthkeeperalliance.com, is we've developed a paradigm that takes large tracts of land that are slated for development. And believe it or not, folks, there's a lot of areas that are not protected from development. We have quite a few. We have great national parks. Mm. We have all kinds of marine sanctuaries. Yet, we still need to really look to conservation, not as from a purely environmental extreme perspective, but to bring a new paradigm to how we develop land. And the idea of undevelopment is to protect it from further intensive development and to limit that on a go-forward basis, but to do it in a way that reflects what I call the quadruple bottom line, that is not just about profits, but it's about people, planet, profits, and we're doing something purposefully. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea. To undevelopment, it applies to every business, and every individual on this planet to put it to good use.
You know, you bring to mind my hometown of Phoenix, Arizona, and when I grew up, we had what they would call the monsoon that would roll through. You never said monsoon storm because it was a redundancy. That's what monsoon means. But they had what would roll through prior to the rain and the wind, prior to the rain, was what they finally started terming after I left Phoenix. They said that these giant dust storms, they were called haboobs. I mean, that it was a haboob. That was the name of it, I guess, in Arabic or whatever the language was. And so when I was growing up as a kid, you'd get the dust storms rolling in, follow with the wind and the all that stuff and the leaves and everything gets kicked up, and then immediately followed by a beautiful rain shower with colored lightning. I still remember the colored lightning, greens and reds and so forth, or pinks and what have you. And it would just rinse all the dust off, and it would cool things down, and it was wonderful. And this was back in the 60s and the 70s. And then as time progressed and the city grew, and I knew what was happening, they were digging up and developing the land, and instead of incorporating the flora back into the development, they would obliterate it, and then they would truck in whatever plants they wanted, maybe more palm trees or something like this. I've never seen a desert with palm trees, honestly. I have never seen a desert scene. I don't see any palm trees in the Sahara. They're not native. Anyway, what I noticed was they were replacing the flora with concrete.
Right.
And asphalt that retains the heat. And so by the time I was 30, we had the hottest day on record in 1990, and it was 122 in the shade. And I knew exactly why that was, because there was nothing there to release the heat. It wasn't there. And that seems to be what has created a lot of the issues. And I would say that there's a certain element right in that example of how man has affected his own environment. So they don't get the rains like they used to. They still get the dust storms, but by the time the storm front rolls up from the south, the heat from the heat island effect, it blows it out like a candle, and they wonder why. I am not a meteorologist. I am not someone who has studied these things. I'm an observer, and I could see what was happening. And I don't have a hometown to go home to anymore. It's been destroyed.
And now those dust storms come a lot more.
Yeah.
Not more often, but take that example, which is a very good one, because certainly it's urbanization at its
worst.
I guess.
I'll say it
as
worst.
You go ahead and say it, Richard, but take that hundreds of folds as we apply it to the planet as a whole. And it's no wonder we're having the issues that we're having. I hope you keep next time you go to Phoenix, you have a cold glass of lemonade.
Oh, yeah. Well, I will only go in December, as long as in December it's still below 70 degrees.
Well, the rest of those Phoenicians, they come right out here to Santa Barbara in the West Coast. Can't blame them.
I can't either, although I've heard of people who want to move there, and I say, you can have my spot. I'm not even going to sell it to you. It's yours for free. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the other things that Earth Keepers Alliance is doing to support folks in their effort to make a difference, to make a change, even if it is just in their little world, like ours up on the hill, where I can't change the way things are being done in Los Angeles or New York or Phoenix, but I can affect my space in where I am living. And so when we come back, we'll talk more about that. We're talking with Adam C. Hall. He's the author of The Earth Keeper. And we want you to stay with us here on Tell Me Your Story. TheEarthKeeperAlliance.com is also the website. Subtitle of the book, The Earth Keeper, is Undeveloping the Future. And we want you to stay with us. We will be talking more about all of this, and we certainly hope that you will go to the website. Stay tuned. And we're back on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Adam C. Hall. He's the author of The Earth Keeper, Undeveloping the Future. The website is earthkeeperalliance.com. That's earthkeeperalliance.com, where you can find out more about what the Earth Keepers are doing and what the Earth Keeper Alliance is doing to support you and others who want to make a difference, who, as I was saying in our previous segment, even if you were to push aside all of the arguments over whether there is or isn't climate change or is or isn't global warming, there's an old saying that you do not defecate where you eat. And I'm putting that in an appropriate FCC-approved vernacular. Animals don't do that, but man does. I mean, almost literally does. We've even heard of, again, the E. coli outbreaks coming from lettuce from fields in California or in other parts of the Southwest in particular, or wherever they're growing the various crops. So we are doing just that. We're not maintaining our cleanliness in that regard, shall we say. But it goes deeper than that, because we have taken to just dumping stuff everywhere. But what is the Alliance, the Earth Keeper Alliance, doing to help people, to teach people, but also to help to, whether you want to use the word undevelop or clean up the messes, even on small scales that become a large scale thing, in terms of making our living space a better place?
And exactly. And it's really about how we're taking action in our own personal lives, because obviously, as you pointed out, Richard, it can be pretty daunting out there to see what's going on. Of course, it all begins at home.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. And home meaning not only in our own yards, but ultimately in our communities. And one of the things that we've done over at the Earth Keeper Alliance is we have launched a 501c3, a nonprofit called Urban Garden Community. And Urban Garden Community is really about sponsoring local gardeners to do two things. One is to cultivate and grow organic food and food, vibrant food, for not only their own personal consumption, but perhaps others in the communities that aren't as fortunate. So we always support folks that are growing locally, and to buy from them and create your own garden. But the main thrust of what we're doing at Urban Community Garden is really, Richard, is to focus on the education and mentorship of inner city youth, at-risk youth in inner cities. And we are just launching this program in Los Angeles, and looking to do something up in the Bay Area as well. And the idea really here is how do we help impoverished children that live in the cycle of poverty? There are 16.7 million children every day in America that go hungry. Hard to imagine, 16.7 million of them. Mm. And ultimately, many, if not most of them, is a result of this continuing generational impoverished way of life. And the idea here is let's bring them into the earth. Let's get them connected to the greater vibrancy and potential of an urban garden to grow food.
But when you use the term impoverished, that does not necessarily imply that they are in the socioeconomic context, poor or below the poverty level. From what I'm hearing, these are impoverished individuals more from, shall we say, an intellectual and or emotional level, because they're disconnected from nature.
Well, good point. Because I checked the last box, all of the above.
Okay.
On that one, I think you're exactly right. There is this NDD And ultimately, that has resulted in that disconnectivity to what is really healthy food. Imagine, you know, just the food has actually become very expensive for most and for many. And what that is creates is it hitting a default mechanism to buy processed food. Food that is really dead for all intensive purposes, no pun intended, but it's not providing the nutrients that a lot of these children need. So we're supporting that. We believe that that is a great trend line, especially to allow people to move away from genetically modified foods and allow them to move away from big agriculture and to really support the vibrancy within their own garden, including the vibrancy of pollinators like bees and bats and butterflies. And these are really critical things that are happening on the planet that we can enjoy in our own neighborhoods or in our own backyard. The other thing that we are very active in is really it's environmental awareness. And we have a group called, a site called earthkeepermovement.org. And I encourage everybody to come and put your name in there. We'll share with you a lot of great information and tips around what we're doing around the planet and some of the things that you should be aware of and some of the things that I think are really important issues that are about your health and vitality, like this radioactivity that is floating in across the West Coast. Maybe it's innocuous for many to say, and it's to that limited degree. But the point of the matter is, what does that do to our environment?
Yeah.
What, even on an incremental level, how does that change populations of fish in migrations? For example, there is the lowest number of sardine species in the area here right off of Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, and San Diego in decades. Mm. Don't be surprised if next year we see less migration of dolphins, less migration of other seabirds like the pelicans. So a lot of things happening out there that it's good to be aware of them, not to be fearful of them, but good to put them in the hopper and do something about it in our own lives to support ourselves, our families, and our communities.
Have you noticed that nature has a way of not only providing us an opportunity like the gyres? It's like, okay, the earth is saying, I'm not going to make you scour the seven seas to try to gather all this stuff up. I'm going to collect it up for you if you will just do something about it, if you will come down and take it in little bite-sized pieces and do what you can.
Yeah.
Do you see that occurring more and more, that the living planet, shall we say, is just constantly giving us those opportunities? It's just not about erupting volcanoes that are destroying civilization, and that's how it's going to happen, and we're going to be wiped off the planet.
I really do. I am so optimistic, really, about our humanity, and I say that because I believe that each of us, and collectively as a community, can come together and to find a greater balance with the earth and to work with the earth instead of degrading the earth. And there is somewhat of a prerequisite that I would put forth, or a proposition for people to really consider. And that is, in order to do or engage what you have saying around these, say, collecting pools of plastics and pollutants, and there's all kinds of other possibilities about how we can mimic the nature and work with nature through it's a biomimicry process.
Right.
There's all kinds of things we can do. But until such time, Richard, that we are in a greater connectivity with ourselves, then we're going to just continue along with the attitude, well, we really don't care. We really will allow our policies and our big business to continue to collectively degrade the environment of which supplies our food, our abundance, our way of life. And that will just continue until such time as we say to ourselves, hey, I care. because each of us can make a difference. It begins with each of us. And when that occurs, my gosh, it is quantum in its power and its ability to really make the difference that I believe the Earth is calling for and our humanity needs. It is the imperative of our time.
Yeah. You know, before I saw this video of this young guy from, I want to say the Netherlands, who came up with this unbelievable idea, this massive collection device around these gyres, one of my thoughts was, if there was a way for us to send giant tankers down there to collect this stuff up, because that was my concept, send a bunch of tankers down there empty, fill them up, and then tote all of this stuff to the nearest volcano and just toss it in. I mean, you got to believe that the toxins coming off of that volcano and the molten lava that's coming off have to be more toxic than anything you're going to throw in there that's going to burn. I mean, that's where my mindset was.
We're
right?
going to send you up there to do the tossing.
I bet you will.
You can volunteer. We'll send Nat Geo out there. You will get a camera crew to follow you.
There you go. But that thinking process is what's gotten us into the problem we're in, because we're not thinking to the end result. Okay, if I do this and I do this and then this happens and this happens, what's going to be the final end result here? Now, let's just say, for the sake of argument, that's what we chose to do. We're going to collect this stuff up and we're going to drop it into an active volcano, and it's just going to vaporize this stuff. And then you have all the toxins that are going to come off of, especially the plastics, for example. And some would say, well, yeah, but look at all the toxins that are already coming off of the volcano. Yeah, but why would you want to add to that? And where is that gas going to go? What are the air currents, and where is it going to take it? And then you start thinking down these lines and going, you know, maybe this is not a good idea. So let's not go that direction, because this could actually be more harmful to us. You know, even though, okay, we're cleaning up the ocean, great, but we're now polluting the air and toxifying ourselves.
Well, you bring up a really good point, and it kind of goes back to, if we think about recycling and the recycling programs that have been implemented over time. Hey, great. That's fantastic. You know, it's interesting because I take the trash out of my home.
Yeah.
And when I drop a bag in the dump that's going to go to the waste, to the, you know, the
landfill.
A landfill. Yeah. There's one or two bags in there a week.
Yeah.
But when I look over into my recycling,
yeah,
that recycling bin is full.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing? No, that's not a good thing, because I'm still consuming so much that I'm still creating recycling. So the point is, how do we
short
circuit a little bit how we create our, I guess, excess or waste?
Right. Or more to the point, it's not so much that you're consuming as much as what you're consuming is still overpackaged. That seems to be, I mean, I have seen.
That makes total sense. It's in packaging, it's in consumption, it's in.
It is, it's certainly, I'm not going to ignore that. I remember after my interview with Jacques Fresco of the Venus Project out in Florida, and I'm hoping to have him on again in the near future. I'm hoping and praying he's still alive. He was 94 when I interviewed him last. Mm-hmm. But after the interview, I got to thinking about one of his principles, being that his new civilization, his concept was that it would not be monetarily based, it would be resource-based, and the resources would belong to all the people. Well, one of my concepts was, in trying to explain this to people, I said, okay, we're still going to manufacture, let's say, these little flash drives, okay? And it's got multiple gigabytes of space, and because we're still going to use it, we still have the technology. But there will be a store down the road, in a manner of speaking, that would have these products. And I could walk in and just take one out of the bin and walk out the store, because it's not monetarily, you know, we don't have a monetary system. And a guy could come up to me with a gun and say, I want that flash drive. And I would gladly give it to him, not because of self-preservation, but because I can go back to the store and get another one, which I would also tell him that this has no value to me. And if you want it, I'll give it to you and save you the trip to the store. I have no problem with that, because I'm just going to go back there where you could go and get one. But it would just be the flash drive. It wouldn't be in a blister pack with a piece of cardboard wrapped in plastic, put in a box wrapped in plastic, which is what we do when we don't want someone to steal these little items, whatever they are, from the store. with the security tag or whatever you have that's also built into the packaging. Instead, you just have a bin filled with all of these things. Or when you go to the farmer's market, you take your canvas bags or whatever bags that you have, and you fill it up with the raw vegetables and fruits and maybe even the meats and so forth. You don't have a lot of packaging, whereas you go to the grocery store, and especially between, what is it, the meat section and the produce section in the middle of the store where everything's processed, what do you have? You have metals and plastics and papers that are containing all of these processed foods, which aren't good for you anyway, but you don't have that when you go to the produce section in the same context, or you go to your farmer's market.
Exactly.
You don't have that. So that to me is where we also need to be looking too, and trying to get, I guess, corporate America that provides us with the foods not to use so much packaging, to find another way to, I mean, bulk foods in some of the stores like Whole Foods or Trader Joe's and so on and so forth is a great concept. Of course, you still need some container to put the bulk loose food in, you know, so you're still packaging it, but it's much less.
Well, you're right. And innovation, you know, there is innovation.
Yeah.
And obviously, we have a lot more room to be innovative. But one of the ways that I found to be innovative in my own life is as follows. Why do I need to get a new car when I have a perfectly good car right now?
Yeah.
Even if I went and got maybe a photovoltaic car or a hydrogen car coming out, which I may do. I'm looking at a hydrogen car potentially. But the greatest consumption and consuming thing I could do was actually to keep turning over my vehicle every 3 or 4 years like the average American does. And that process of that consumption, what goes into a car in terms of imprint, is astronomical.
Well, and you raise a very interesting point. By the same token, there would be those who would argue against your position by saying, well, it doesn't make any difference whether you buy that car, the photovoltaic or the hybrid or whatever, because the factory is still going to make them. Whether you buy it or not, they're going to keep making them. And at the same time, with your point taken, I'm in agreement. I used the same, for example, the same cell phone for several years. I was using, for example, Windows, I think it was Windows 98. I was using it until like 2006, and it was working just fine. Why do I need to upgrade my software? Now, thank God that in the digital age, a lot of what we run on our computers, we can download, so it's just digital. But let's take it to another point, because you brought this up earlier. I want to put solar cells up on my house.
Right.
But is the manufacturing of the solar cell generating more disruption in the natural flow of things just so that I can use sunlight to power my computer? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This is one of the arguments
right.
that people who are adamantly opposed to this whole business of hardcore conservation and cleanup and so forth. They're not opposed to it in general, but in terms of the hardcore people who, you know, it's all or nothing kind of thing. They say, okay, well, great. You want to put cells up on top of your solar cells up on top of your house. What is it taking to produce those cells? How much energy is having to be generated just to manufacture them? In terms of the processing, is it higher or lower than what you're going to get out of them over the term of usage?
Well, it's certainly a legitimate concern, an appropriate one. I mean, yeah. I think anything that we are as co-creators of products and innovations and things like solar power, we have to look at what is that cost benefit. We got to look at it in terms of, wait a second, what is that cost benefit over the time? Mm-hmm. How much carbon imprint is that reducing and taking say, away from the grid.
Right.
And so there's all kinds of things that go into the equation, but ultimately at the end of the day, what we are looking to do is keep this planet and to keep it from being ourselves degrading it to such a degree through carbon production, through our addiction to petroleum and other types of intensive industries,
right,
to keep that at its minimum and to reduce it ultimately to zero. And that's not out of the question. It can be done, and it's coming.
What is it? There are two different carbon gases. There's carbon monoxide, but also carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
Man expels, and all other living creatures expel carbon dioxide,
mm-hmm,
correct?
Mm, correct.
And there is only one thing on the planet that generates oxygen. It actually takes that carbon dioxide and converts it.
Hmm.
And I don't know, I'd heard something about how the level of oxygen that used to come from South America, Brazil, specifically the rainforests,
mm-hmm,
has dropped. I mean, they found a way to measure it to where, because they've been cutting the trees down like crazy down there, you know, our oxygen producing regions is decreasing. In other words, the carbon dioxide surge is going to build up because there's nothing to convert it.
Well, I'm no scientist, but these are relevant questions, and it's not just in the rainforest around the globe, but other type of forest in particular. Mm-hmm. For example, in China, much of their forest has been cut down. In some instances, over 80% has been cut down. The bigger issue that really is coming around this idea of oxygenation is occurring around genetically modified trees and how we seem to be wanting to implement some genetic engineering around tree, ostensibly to produce a faster growing tree to create more timber and timber production. And the question is, well, how does that affect the oxygenation process? How does that affect pesticides and other bugs that are feed off of these trees? I mean, we're seeing a lot of things happening with pine on the West Coast, with infectious pesticides and other things. So there's a lot of big questions facing this planet, and I think the key is doing good work like you are, Richard, because you're asking questions, and we should ask these questions as we do and conduct our lives in ways that hopefully have a level of consciousness that's not about destroying the planet, but really saying, do I really need this, or how is this going to affect others, and really take that to heart in your decision-making process.
And that it raises, I mean, appreciate your comments. It's one of these things that, and I'm seeing this in a lot of documentaries more and more, in terms of their observations of what man is doing to the planet and how he's doing it and so on and so forth, and what we can do to sort of fix the problem or at least minimize the speed at which this is happening. And I still remember prior to December 21st, 2012, I was seeking out guests who would talk on a positive and optimistic level about the day after. But I got a hold of this one woman, never had her on the program because I thought it's too much of a downer. 97% of the Earth's population was supposed to be wiped out on that day. And at first blush, I thought, well, you know, that could solve the whole pollution problem. 97% of 7 billion people gone? Okay. I don't know that we'd be able to sustain man on the planet with only 3% of the population left. But some even say that there's just too many of us.
Yeah.
But how do you educate people on these kinds of things when they're so vested in their particular lifestyles, regardless of what it is that drives them forward, whether it be the way that they were raised by their families, the way they were educated by their schools, or whether they were taught by their religious institutions?
Yes, yeah. Does anybody really think that we can control population? I mean, China has put those types of policies in place. But does anybody really think that's the case? And perhaps maybe it's time that we think, well, there are a lot of people on this planet. Yes, maybe there's just too many for this planet to help. But it's just a fact if that's just what it is and it's growing. And so, wait a second. Maybe it's not that we have too many people on this planet. We have too many people on the planet doing things and not enough people on the planet being who we truly are.
Yeah.
And that the idea of what you just mentioned around education is let's get in touch of our being, because when we are in touch with our being, then we are in touch with nature and we are in balance, and that will align us to conduct ourselves and do things that works for the benefit of the whole of the system, not just my pocketbook, so to speak. And I talk a lot about this in terms of the book, Richard, because it is about the future, and it is about creating a roadmap to our future and how each of us individually can create that roadmap. And we can certainly talk about that at another show or when time permits, but that really is the message here. Where do we go? How do we create a roadmap to the future to live our lives most fully in community and support of others as well?
Well, I have a deep philosophical question for you in light of our immediate conversation here. And I posed this to one of my guests. He's a professor of philosophy at City College. His name is Mark McIntyre. And we were sitting chatting on a program. I had him on, and I said to him, in light of some of our what we've just talked about, I said, why is it important? Why is it necessary for man to continue? And I had to preface it by saying that I'm not advocating annihilation. Okay, I'm saying as of and this was before January 1st, 2014. I said, okay, as of January 1st, 2014, there will be no more conceiving of children. In other words, whoever's here at midnight on December 31st, 2013, that's it. We're done. We're not going to make any more people because we don't need any more. And so it led me to this question of, why is it important for us as a species to continue?
It isn't. It isn't necessarily the imperative. The universe doesn't think that way. But it's important for humanity to understand the importance of why in the natural evolution of humanity, why that is important. And whether that's through propagating more humans, that is one conversation, and it's a good conversation. But is in terms of how we live our lives and move forward, that is what I see is what's important. And it really is this new human that's coming forth.
Mm-hmm.
It's not designed like our old selves. It's designed in a way that is integrating our inner and outer world. And in that process gives our greater connectivity and greater alignment with the Earth, the planet that we live on, that holds the capacity for all life. And I don't see in the context of the natural world or the universal evolution that it is important. As a matter of fact, there's no relevancy at all in that context. However, in the context of the vibrancy of humanity, we should think of that not necessarily solely in terms of propagation of individuals, but really how we individuate in our own lives to have greater connectivity with one another and greater collaboration and cooperation and co-creation with one another, as that is the vibrancy that calls us now. And I believe that is what's important as it relates to why humanity will continue, because I am an optimistic about it. Yet I believe, like you, there is a great imperative, and the complacency that is occurring is one that is one that I believe creates great danger for all of humanity.
Well, it, of course, raises those the two questions that I would kind of put to you. And you are optimistic, so you obviously have a vision for where you would like us to go as compared to your maybe less subjective, more objective, the observer. Where are we going?
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because that is exactly what I was just sharing. And we are heading towards this new greater human capacity that hasn't been seen in the last 5,000 years. And that is occurring as we speak around the globe. And it has to do with a greater level of consciousness and a greater level of understanding of this human OS, this human operating system.
Mm-hmm.
And that through that understanding and through that knowledge that has been attained around how our DNA works, how we interact in the world, we don't inherit the world, we create the world. We mm-hmm. Each of us are co-creators in the world, and we do not necessarily live within the genetics of our past and our ancestors, that we can move beyond all of those type of preordained, quote-unquote, type of moments that we've lived in our lives. The world is moving into a greater individuation that has this complete connectivity within one another, and this greater cooperation and collaboration through the human journey, through the human experience, to come together to not simply solve the greatest issues of our time and to deal with the crisis that really faces humanity, but to come to a place where we are in this collaboration. And this is what goes to the very core of why I wrote this book. And it was about my own personal journey getting to that place of that greater individuation that has that greater connectivity to the oneness of it all, to understand the simplicity of it and the magnificence of it all, but in to do so in a place of greater virtue and greater service, and not only to fulfill our own life's journey and share the gifts that each and every one of us has, but ultimately really to show up and to come together. So for the joy of life and for the fun of it, it's time to let that dawn rise and get our dance shoes on and do a little singing and have some fun together and have some great fellowship and stewardship of this planet.
I used to ask people, and I'll kind of put this to you, I used to ask people, not necessarily in the context of this program, but just in daily conversation and at a particular period a couple of years ago, why are we here? I mean, not necessarily, the philosophical, great questions,
right.
Where are we from? Where are we going? Why are we here? What is,
sure.
But more, what is it that we're here to achieve? I'm not advocating that we build, the Tower of Babel, because we kind of saw how that went. That didn't work out so well. But what is it that man is here to do? And you've, I think, basically addressed that, because the one word that always came back was to experience joy. Period.
Yes.
I had one guy that's all he said.
Yes, it very much so. And just imagine for a moment that you are a flower in the garden and that you are the seed that is now blossoming. And imagine yourself as the blossom on the flower. Pick your color, pick your scent, pick your life, whatever to choose. But we are here to unfold in all that magnificence. And that may sound a little woo-woo-ish, but really, it really is about that. And why wait? Why wait?
When you think about growing up as a child in I'll just use the term pseudo-normal home, okay? we all had this stuff going on in our lives. You did that. You imagined things. I would don and destroy a number of my mother's towels playing superhero. yeah. you know, with my brother and so forth. Build forts in the backyard and play with little army men or whatever, trucks and digging in the dirt. Used to be accused of wanting to dig to China, you know. I never even thought to get a globe and try to figure out, okay, what was exactly opposite. I have a funny feeling it was probably somewhere out in the middle of the Indian Ocean or something. Yeah. But those were the kinds of things that you did as a child. But and I've even heard this. It's a poem that I used to hear Paul Harvey refer to before his passing about how wouldn't it be nice to be able to walk out the front door of your home and you didn't have a watch and you didn't have a wallet and you didn't have any money in your pocket and you didn't have all of the things that you and I carry with us all the time, right?
Well, hopefully you have your clothes on.
Well, you have your clothes. and you just went out and you explored the day. And, of course, it came around to that, well, yeah, and that's what you used to do as a child.
Yes.
You know, and yet we're now so bound by social convention, the rules and so forth. You don't get in your car unless you have your driver's license with you, kind of thing.
Well, you don't even think in certain ways.
And you exactly.
You don't feel in certain ways.
Yeah.
It's just stunning how anesthetized I became in my own personal life, because you inspired in me a thought around my own childhood of how I lived so free.
Yeah.
I had only one rule, and that was laid down by my mother: be home for dinner at sunset.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
From sunrise to sunset, I was free to roam around and have so much fun.
I remember when the neighbor kids and I would, along with my brother, we would be out in the front yard of my parents' house. There were one, two, 3 yards on our side of the block that had no fences, had trees, but no fences. And then the other side of the street, literally across the street, there were no fences on any of the yards from the corner all the way back, almost 10 houses. And we played kickball. And my father's yard, front yard, was the diamond. And I was kicking the ball and sailing it out there because there were no fences. You didn't have to worry about tripping over anything.
Right.
And the beautiful thing was, at one end of the street was ostensibly a T-section. If you crossed, it went into a dead end. So you didn't have to worry about cars coming high speed one way, and it was a T-section at the other end. So you had a nice open space. And at night, we would be racing around the block and in the alleys and everything, playing hide and seek at night, free feeling that we could do whatever we wanted. I mean, you know, obviously,
yes.
You know, without destroying property, having fun.
Yeah, I'm having a good time. And, you know, it's amazing how when the boundaries are set,
yeah.
or the boundaries narrow, especially as we become into our middle and our middle part of our lives, where
yeah.
we are looking to get a job or have a career,
yeah.
or to be somebody, just to be somebody that says, I am a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm an accountant, I am whatever you are.
Yeah.
That becomes who we are. And what happened and what I shared so intimately in The Earth Keeper was, my gosh, I have set such boundaries around myself, I almost can't breathe anymore.
Yeah.
And then, I decided to do something about it because it was strangling my soul's greatest yearning, which is to be free, which is to roam in what I refer to as be wild, not
yeah.
in the negative sense,
right.
but just be wild. And do and embrace that wildness, because it is the place of joy and a lot of fun. So
absolutely,
I'm with you on that, brother.
Yeah, I remember too in my early days bicycling just all over a Phoenix. I mean, I would travel
across
from,
town, probably. Miles.
Oh, absolutely. I would go from Glendale, which is far west Phoenix, at that time anyway, all the way out to Scottsdale, which was far east Phoenix. That's a long way. That's a good. Yeah. I mean, even back then in the 70s, that was still a good 10 or maybe 20 miles.
What a nice ride!
But there
that's
was no
kind of
thought.
Uphill a little bit.
I'm sorry.
You got a little bit of a ride up going from Glendale up, isn't it?
It's not too
a
bad.
Workout.
It's actually when you're starting to head into Scottsdale,
yeah, then it,
50 or 60, 6,000 block, it starts to go up a little bit. It depends upon the street. If you're on, for example, Thomas, it's fairly flat all the way.
Yeah.
But if you go up to Indian School or Camelback, you have Camelback Mountain, and that's a little bit of a rise.
Yeah.
So you had to deal
with that.
It's
all good.
Oh, but it was
all good.
Going to a place that I will always know as Squaw Peak Park, Squaw Peak Mountain.
All right.
They changed it years ago. It's like I'll always know the baseball stadium that the Diamondbacks play in is Bob. It's always going to be, for me, the Bob. But you were free to just roam anywhere and everywhere that I wanted to. And people thought I was crazy for driving in the city traffic. It was like, well, what other choice do I have? And I had, you know, and I was just very, very defensively minded. You know, I didn't count on anybody to do the right thing. It was up to me. It was my responsibility to do the right thing in terms of keeping myself safe. And I would say this, I even said this to my mother. I says, I love you dearly, Mom, but I don't even count on you to do the right thing because it's not your responsibility to take care of me if I'm out on the roads. It's my responsibility. And I took it very seriously, but I still had a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it is all part of this whole process of being an Earth Keeper. And I think that for people to, again, go to the website Earth Keeper Alliance. Now, it's earthkeeperalliance.com.
EarthKeeperAlliance.com to learn about our land platform and what we're doing around conservation, preservation, and restoration, and EarthKeeperMovement.org to hook up with us there. Put your name in. We'd love to stay in touch with you, hear from you, and share ideas and collaborate. And look forward to seeing you out on the path.
And you're based right here in Santa Barbara.
Based right here in Santa Barbara and loving one of the most beautiful places on this planet.
Before we wrap up the program, and I don't know that I asked you these questions when you were on the program last, who is Adam Hall?
Adam Hall is a 52-year-old person that is embracing the love of who he is, the gift of what he has to share, and ultimately to be in greater service to the planet and to serve others, in particular, urban youth that we are mentoring and educating to grow food. And, of course, to share with others to help them to undevelop their future and to help them create a roadmap to the greater wholeness and the greater joy that I would like to see all of us have in our lives. So I'm a dedicated servant, I'm a dedicated steward, and I'm dedicated to the well-being of everyone.
What is it that you hope to achieve? What is it that you want to or hope to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, two things, and thank you for asking that. One is to create a greater conservation mindset around anything to do with the land. And that could be protection of resources, restoration of habitats, and also putting into perpetuity the preservation of land so it's not developed and certainly not overdeveloped or anywhere near that. So that is the primarily objective of what we're doing. We're also facilitating ideas around renewable energy on some of the sites that we have. So we're looking deeply into renewable energy farms and other things that hold great potential. And then secondarily, on a personal level, more of an intimate level, it is this greater connectivity with others like you, Richard, others in this community, to share in fellowship, to share in the joy, to share in the challenges that we have, because being a human being is extraordinarily challenging, at least I've found it to be, extraordinarily humbling, but to show up and allow that to unfold and to support that within each of you. So I look forward to doing that.
How powerful are we as human beings?
Extraordinarily. It's if you could imagine the power of the universe, if you could imagine the power of nature, even sometimes we witness it in its all its glory, but all it could be quite violent. I think one thing we can say, whatever the case may be, when we witness a tornado or a storm like Sandy or some of the other things that are happening around the globe, that we too have this great power to not necessarily conduct ourselves in a violent manner, in a reactive manner like we have with all the wars and things that we conduct ourselves, even in an innocuous way. Our governing systems are very about battling and destroying one another, winners and losers. We have such a great capacity, Richard, that I believe that humankind can resolve any issue in collaboration with technology and without technology to facilitate this greater unfolding of humanity. But we are at that point, that intersection, and that tipping point, so to speak, where it's time to show up, make some decisions, come together, and take action. We are powerful, and we can do it as co-creators with the universe.
EarthKeeperAlliance.com and EarthKeeperMovement.org. The book is entitled The Earthkeeper, Undeveloping the Future. My guest has been Adam C. Hall, and I want to thank you so much for taking so much time with us here on the program today. And look forward to seeing you at the book signing on March 6th
at Chaucer's.
Yes. And what time?
At 7 p.m. So come on out, even just to say hi. Check out the books. Perusal around. We'll connect there.
I tell you, that's a fun bookstore. It really is. I've been in there many times.
Yes, awesome bookstore, and let's support our local indie books.
Absolutely. Again, Adam C. Hall, my guest, The Earthkeeper, Undeveloping the Future. And you're listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.